Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and go to Palestine, and we'll speak with Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, who's a medical doctor and the president of the Palestinian National Initiative, a democratic opposition movement. He was a candidate for the presidency of the Palestinian National Authority in 2005, finishing second after Mahmoud Abbas. He is the only independent, or one of the few independent politicians in Palestine who is neither Fatah or Hamas. We'll be talking to him in a moment about the Israeli ground invasion of the Gaza and get his response to that breaking story. And then we'll go to Israel and speak with Gershom Gorenberg, who's author and journalist based in Israel. His books of The End of Days, Fundamentalism and the Struggle for the Temple Mount, Shalom, Friend, The Life and Legacy of Yitzhak Rabin. And his new book is The Accidental Empire, Israel and the Birth of the Settlements. So we'll be talking to Gershom Gorenberg in Israel to get his perspective on what is happening now in terms of a widening war between the Israeli Defense Forces and Hamas in Gaza. And then in the third segment of the first hour, we'll discuss whether or not President Bush and Vice President Cheney will go to jail. Not a question of whether they should go to jail, but whether they will go to jail. We'll be speaking to Scott Horton, who's a writer, analyst, and attorney, known for his work in international law, human rights, and the law of armed conflict. He's a professor at Columbia Law School and is a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. His Harper's weblog, No Comment, is highly regarded and covers issues ranging from American law and politics to international affairs. Let's now go to Palestine. I'm speaking with Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, who is a medical doctor and the president of the Palestinian National Initiative, a democratic opposition movement. And Dr. Barghouti, you are one of the few independent politicians in Palestine, not allied to Fatah or Hamas, but obviously you are, your country is in an extremely uncomfortable position. What's the latest news that you can give us of the Israeli ground invasion of the Gaza?
Well, it's not anymore an invasion or an incursion. It's a full-scale war where Israel is using Air Force, F-16 jet fighters, Apache helicopters, tanks, military force, and they are inviting now tens of thousands of reservists. It's very clear that Israel is reoccupying Gaza completely, and that is creating a total humanitarian crisis. First of all, there are 510 people killed, including 120 children. There are about 2,760 people injured, including 1,000 women and children. And the whole Gaza Strip, which has been under terrible siege for more than 2 years, deprived of basic needs, including fuel and medications, is now without electricity, without fuel, without medications, without flour, without bread. It's a total humanitarian crisis, and that little place, which is only 220 square miles, with the largest or the highest densely populated area in the world, with 7,000 people per square mile, is now bombarded by air, by sea, and by the artillery and tanks. The Israeli troops have already cut Gaza, this little area, into three pieces, creating three different ghettos. And at the same time, the humanitarian condition is awful. With the passage of every minute, more people get killed by the Israeli attacks. Just 2 hours ago, a mother and four of her children were killed by an Israeli airstrike. It's an awful situation, and we're very worried that the world community is doing nothing to stop this, nothing to impose a ceasefire on Israel.
And assuming that the world community continues to be useless in this situation, and the U.S., of course, vetoed any U.N. resolution, we then have to deal with facts on the ground. What kind of facts on the ground do you think the Israelis will end up with?
Reactivation of full-scale occupation. that is nothing of an achievement. I think after 41 years of military occupation of West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, and after partial redeployment from Gaza, which did not really end occupation, but at least got the Israeli army out of the scene of the people for a certain amount of time, now their solution to the problem of occupation is more occupation and further occupation. I think that's a big failure of the policy, of the Israeli politics, and it's an outcome of the fact that the international community, and especially the United States, has allowed Israel to go beyond any limits and to feel that it is impunitive to international law. And the fact that they are bombarding people who are under their occupation today in Gaza is a proof to that. Unfortunately, the Israeli government speaks about peace and conducts a huge war and a terrible massacre against civilian population. They speak about stopping the missiles of Hamas, but actually they are refusing a ceasefire which would guarantee that no missiles would be shot. They speak about the problem of occupation, and they solve it by expanding this occupation. They speak about stopping violence, and instead of stopping the violence, they're creating more violence by creating total devastating destruction in Gaza Strip. At the same time, Israel keeps claiming that it is the victim in this conflict. It's really amazing, but sometimes I feel that the Israeli government wants the world to think that Israel is not only the weak David, but also at the same time the mighty Goliath. The truth, it is the Israeli Goliath with the fifth largest military army in the world today against the Palestinian David, which is weak, isolated, ghettoized, and put under terrible bombardment.
But Dr. Baghouti, if the history between the Israelis and the Palestinians is to be a competition between who is the greater victim, then there is no hope.
Of course, and I'm not fighting to be a victim. I'm just telling you the truth. Because the Israeli spokespeople who appear like 100 times more than Palestinian on the world media keep claiming that Israel is the victim while it is bombarding and killing people in such a vicious way. I am not struggling to have the status of a victim, and I don't like to be victimized, but at the same time, one has to recognize the fact that you cannot equate between an occupier and occupied, an oppressor and an oppressed, an aggressor and people who are under aggression. At the same time, while I negate all forms of violence, and I have been calling for nonviolence all my life, because I think that's the best and most human way of struggling for your rights, at the same time, I cannot speak, the world cannot speak about one part of violence and ignore the huge amount of violence that is practiced by the Israeli army.
So I take it you spoke out against Hamas firing missiles at Israeli civilians.
Not only that, I personally participated with President Abbas in brokering with Haniyeh at one point of time a ceasefire and a truce that lasted for 6 months. That was the first truce, and then there was a second truce that the Egyptians brokered. And till 2 months, that truce was working, and there were no missiles. And unfortunately, the Israelis insisted on invading Gaza and conducting attacks which took the lives of 6 people. And then there was a response from Hamas, and then we had this vicious cycle. But if you go back to the Israeli press and look at the media 2 months ago, you would notice how many statements the defense minister of Israel, Ehud Barak, have been saying that Israel needed this truce to prepare for this huge operation. So it was practically a preparation for this military invasion. I just read an email which indicates how even the PR media attack, which we see today in a very sophisticated manner by the Israeli media groups, has also been prepared 8 months ago in anticipation of this huge attack on Gaza, which is nothing but re-establishing full military occupation.
And of course, Dr. Baghouti, it's no secret that Israeli domestic politics are playing a big role in this, as Ehud Barak, his political fortunes are now on the line, and Benjamin Netanyahu is breathing down his neck. You can't dismiss the political posturing going on here. But give us a sense of the politics on your side, on the Palestinian side, since you are an independent politician It's no secret that Fatah and Hamas don't have any affection for each other. It's also no secret that the Egyptian government is not particularly sympathetic to Hamas, who they consider to be allied with the Muslim Brotherhood. What's going on in terms of a backlash against both Fatah and the Egyptian government?
Well, first of all, let me say that, of course, this division internally has helped the Israelis in many ways. But that division, when we managed to overcome it and create national unity government, unfortunately, the Israelis managed to mobilize the world, first, of course, the United States and then other countries, to isolate the national unity government, which, in my opinion, had a rather flexible program, a rather moderate program, and would have co-opted probably all the political forces, including Hamas, into a peace process. Unfortunately, that government was surrounded, embargoed, and till it fell down, and then we have this terrible division. And this division is helping nobody, and it is being exploited and sometimes even used by external parties. Now I think there is a new reality that is appearing on the ground, which is that practically all Palestinians are under full-fledged occupation. And this whole stupid fight between Fatah and Hamas for positions in an authority which really did not have a real authority, an authority under occupation, practically weakened us. And both Fatah and Hamas fell in that trap. I think the reality is clear today. As long as we are not independent, we cannot have a sovereign authority. And that's why I think while Hamas is being weakened by military attacks, the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, and Fatah in particular, has lost a lot of its credibility, specifically because of these attacks. At the end of the day, I think all Palestinians today realize that we have to be unified, and we have to find a way of resolving even the differences in a democratic and nonviolent manner.
And what do you think is going on between Egypt and Hamas, and how much is Egypt's position backfiring in the Arab world? Because they're more and more looking unsympathetic in the eyes of what's loosely referred to as the Arab street, I understand.
There are many sides to this issue. First side is that Hamas is linked to Muslim Brotherhood movement, which is an international movement, but also a pan-Arab movement. And Egypt's main opposition to the existing regime are the Muslim Brothers. They are the strongest opposition. And that's why, of course, there isn't great sympathy to Hamas from that perspective. But that is also a constraining factor, because it means that Egypt does not go too far in upsetting Hamas, because it doesn't want to precipitate a serious response from its own opposition. So it's some kind of love-hate relationship in one way or another. But that is only one perspective. The other perspective of the matter is that, Palestine is very close to Egypt. It's on the borders of Egypt. Palestinian issue has always had an impact on internal Egyptian issues and politics. Please don't forget that in 1948, when there was a war and the Egyptian army failed drastically in defending the Palestinians and was defeated drastically by the Israeli army, this was the main cause and reason for the revolution in Egypt and the change of regime, which took away the king and created the regime of Nasser. So there has always been a serious impact of what happens in Palestine on what happens in Egypt and vice versa. That's why I think the Egyptians are very sensitive today to the great demand that is coming from various sectors in Egyptian society, demanding greater support to the Palestinian cause and greater solidarity, and in particular opening the Rafah crossing, which is closed, creating total embargo on Gaza, of course, because all the other entrances are closed by Israel.
So, Dr. Barghouti, a little while ago you mentioned that you brokered a peace deal with a truce with the Israelis, with Abu Mazen and Haniyeh.
That was in 2006.
With Haniyeh, who is in Gaza and presumably is being targeted. What was the sense in that meeting? of the very issues that you've brought up, the futility of the struggle between Fatah and Hamas. Was that, did you ever try to discuss this with these two major political leaders? In other words,
yeah, of course, I was the main mediator between them, being an independent, being truly the most independent party in the country. We were able to broker that that deal in a way of national unity government and stop the internal competition, which so far has been the most successful experience. Unfortunately, it lasted only for less than 3 months, but. But in doing so, of course, we discussed these differences, and we were trying always to find a way of convincing the two sides with three ideas. The first idea is that they're competing for an authority that is really elusive, and the main thing here is how to find a way of creating joint leadership rather than competition for elusive authority. But the second point was that to convince that both of them, neither of them, actually can run the Palestinian show alone or lead the Palestinian struggle alone, that they have to consider that what we need is some kind of a unified front here. But the third and most important point to me was that we need a democracy and that they can compete. There is nothing wrong with that. And we should have pluralism. That's also natural in a democracy. But you compete in a democratic, peaceful way. And then you accept what people decide. You accept the results of elections. And you don't say that because you chose the other party, I do not accept the results of elections like some Fatah people did. And also you cannot say that, like some Hamas people said, that if I am elected once, then I am elected forever. Neither of these positions are right. So our idea was to consolidate the idea of alternation of power in a peaceful, democratic way. Of course, you have to consider that much of the apathy or antipathy, in a way, to the situation in Gaza by some Arab countries is not really related only to Hamas, because some of them have supported Hamas for a while. It's mainly because they don't like what we've done in terms of creating a democracy in Palestine. And I think that very short democracy spring in Palestine was unfortunately slaughtered by Israel and many surrounding regimes here, who are afraid of the spread of this kind of model where people really choose their leaders through democratic elections. And sooner than later, we as Palestinians will have to come back and find a way out of this mess only through democracy and democratic elections. And even I say this to Israel, you're elusive completely if you think you can impose an agreement on Palestinians or by finding a way of creating some kind of a puppet regime that you control and then impose an agreement on. This has never worked anywhere and will not work here. The only peace that will last is a peace concluded between two democracies that is supported democratically by both people and that is really reflecting the interest of both people in a balanced manner.
But Dr. Baghouti, when you talk of democracy, I understand that Hamas is essentially a theocratic government, is it not? Isn't it a religious-based government?
No. I don't agree with that. They might have had some kind of ideology in the direction of creating an Islamic system, but as a party, they have admitted to democratic system, and they never denied that. And I think that's why Hamas represents a serious change in comparison to other Islamic forces in other parts of the world. And I would have seen this as a positive thing, because what we need is that kind of impact where people who believe in Islam can compete in a democratic way, but non-violently, without turning to violent means of controlling power or to oppressing other people. I do not say that all the people in Hamas are similar. There are definitely different trends, although they are unified in their decision-making system. But when we encouraged the creation of national unity government, we were practically encouraging and strengthening the moderates, the pragmatists, those who are ready to accept democracy as a system.
And just in closing, Dr. Baghouti, it's always argued over here and in the United States and clearly in Israel that Hamas does not want to recognize Israel's existence and therefore How could you negotiate people who want to see you wiped off the map, if I can use that phrase?
Well,
give us a sense of whether, one, you believe that's true, and two, why take this position if the response that we're experiencing now, if it leads to that kind of response? What is in it for Hamas to take this stance?
First of all, I personally think if there is an offer for a two-state solution where a Palestinian state would be created in the boundaries, I mean, according to the borders of 1967, with East Jerusalem as its capital, with real sovereignty, without settlements, I believe even Hamas would accept that. The issue of recognition, of course, I cannot speak on behalf of Hamas because I don't represent them. I am competing with them from political perspective. But I believe there was a similar problem with Fatah before. And it was resolved when there was a mutual agreement from the side of the Israeli government to recognize the PLO and what it aspires to, while PLO recognized Israel. That kind of mutuality is always possible. The problem we face here is that when we say to Hamas that this is something that has to be dealt with, they ask a very simple and correct question, which is, we recognize Israel according to which map? And it's true. Mm-hmm. Israel still did not decide what is the map of Israel. And up till now, they haven't decided to offer neither their people or the world the map of Israel according to which it should be recognized. I'm not saying here that I'm not bringing this as an excuse, but I am saying the mutual recognition has to happen on the basis of an agreed upon borders, on the basis of Israel's accepting the creation of a sovereign, real Palestinian state.
And do you, just in closing, Dr. Baghdadi, do you have any sense of any optimism that Barack Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton will be able to improve the situation?
I hope so. But I think Bush administration has created a very difficult situation for them in cooperation with Israel. This war is a huge wall that was built in front of the new administration. The previous decision of the Security Council, which tries to cluster everybody within the ranks of one thing, which is the Annapolis process, is another obstacle. And I think the creation of this tension now in the Middle East is probably one way of obstructing what Obama spoke about, which is some kind of peaceful dialogue with the other parties in the region. And that's why I think I'm not sure that this was not done on purpose to prevent him really from implementing his program. I hope he will find creative ways of dealing with this matter, and I hope he will find creative ways of showing to that United States is not a follower of what the Israelis want, but actually can have an impartial kind of role that is not absolutely and totally biased to Israel, as is the case today.
I thank you very much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Dr. Mustafa.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Dr. Mustafa Baghdadi, who is a medical doctor and president of the Palestinian National Initiative, a democratic opposition movement. He was a candidate for the presidency of the Palestinian National Authority in 2005, finishing second after Mahmoud Abbas. Dr. Baghdadi currently serves as the Palestinian National Initiative's general secretary, and he was newly elected to a seat on the Palestinian Legislative Council in January of 2006. I'm now speaking with Gershom Gorenberg, who's a journalist and author based in Israel. His books are The End of Days, Fundamentalism and the Struggle for the Temple Mount, and Shalom, Friend, The Life and Legacy of Yitzhak Rabin. And his new book is The Accidental Empire, Israel and the Birth of the Settlements. And Gershom Gorenberg, do you subscribe in any way to the notion that Dr. Baghdadi suggested, that this action now between the IDF and Hamas in Gaza is meant in some way to circumscribe any efforts that Barack Obama may have wanted to make?
No, I don't think that's the case. If there's something in the timing that's connected to American politics, I would say that there was a probably a calculation on the part of Israeli leaders that it would be better to act during the political vacuum in the United States, that there would be less likelihood of a quick American diplomatic intervention now than there would be after January 20th. But I don't think that that was the only calculation in the timing. And in fact, it's entirely possible that whether they intend to do so or not, that by going ahead with this military campaign now, they may, both sides actually may be pushing the next president to get more involved more quickly. If he comes into office with the instability between Israelis and Palestinians very clear and very dangerous, he may feel that this is an issue that can't be put off.
But that's an odd thing. In a sense, what you're saying is that we create a mess and this guy has to sort it out.
Well, I'm basing my comment here on one of the most optimistic comments I can remember in recent day, which is Rahm Emanuel's statement that you never want the serious crisis to go to waste, which the comment I really love because of its, you know,
mordant humor. Yeah.
Well, I'm not even sure if it's mordant. I think it's sort of exuberant. You know, there's a problem, so that gives us a chance to do good things.
Mm-hmm.
It creates the political opportunity, the political constituency for doing something that in normal times might not exist. And you know, that's the question here. Is the unfortunate reality is that most American administrations have waited for something to blow up here before getting involved, rather than engaging in any sort of preventative medicine. This goes back to 1973, just as an example, where there were all the available signs that that a war was very likely, and Nixon and Kissinger ignored those signs. After the war, they had no choice but to get involved, and actually got involved in in a way that began a peace process. So there's the possibility that coming into office in the midst of or immediately after a Israeli-Palestinian crisis may push Obama in the direction of getting more involved.
Well, Gershon Grunberg, let's try and figure out then what the end game is for Barak and the IDF, and clearly I think you have to agree with Dr. Barghouti that this is not something that just suddenly happened off the cuff. This by its very nature had to be an operation that was well and long planned. But still, what do you think is the end game? One, in terms of the intentions of Barak and the IDF, and two, what is the result likely to be? In other words, what do you think they're trying to achieve, and what do you think they're going to end up with?
Look, there's been some confusion and some a real lack of clarity about the goals of the military campaign from the Israeli side. I would actually go a step back before that, because the brinkmanship here, the crisis, began as rocket fire from the Gaza Strip into Israel stepped up, and particularly as Hamas announced that it was not going to renew the very tenuous six-month ceasefire that had existed between it and Israel. And I think that that was the first stage of brinkmanship. I think that Hamas was hoping that that by stepping up the rocket fire, they would push Israel to agree to an improved ceasefire, one that would allow a greater flow of goods into and out of Gaza, that would really relieve the siege conditions that they've been under. That was brinkmanship, and I think it led over the brink into the abyss. I think that if the Hamas leadership had been thinking about how the Israelis would have reacted, they would have realized that they were not likely to get the reaction they wanted. In turn, I think that the Israeli response has had two levels of goals. One level is we've got to stop this rocket fire. We've got to achieve what we consider to be an improved ceasefire, one in which there is an absolute end to any attack on Israeli civilians. But there's certainly people in the Israeli leadership who would like to see the campaign result in the collapse of Hamas rule in the Gaza Strip. That's very dangerous because, first of all, if Hamas rule does collapse, what's going to take its place? Israel does not want to reoccupy the Gaza Strip. It would find itself caught again in a guerrilla war against forces inside the Strip, non-state actors with inside the Strip, as the current nomenclature goes. I can't see any international body or force leaping at the opportunity to control Gaza. Egypt certainly isn't going to want the job. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is not going to want to be seen as retaking Gaza on the backs of Israeli tanks. So there's a very serious risk of creating a vacuum in Gaza, which would actually be more dangerous to Israel than the situation which existed before.
And what about a third possibility, which is the Israeli Defense Forces occupying the strip from which these rockets have been launched as a buffer and presumably as a negotiating chip?
Well, that's also a possibility, but it raises a very serious likelihood of a repeat of the South Lebanon scenario, the many years in which Israel was holding South Lebanon as a buffer between Hezbollah forces in Lebanon and Israeli soil. And two things came out of that which eventually convinced Israel to give up on that. One was that it made Israeli forces targets for ongoing guerrilla warfare. And one of the great ironies that we've seen in many places is that conventional armies actually have a very, very difficult time dealing with less armed, less organized forces that are well-based in the local population. So that would be the first problem that Israel would face. And the second is, obviously, that the response on the Palestinian or on the Hamas side would be simply to try to develop missiles that could have a slightly longer range and go over the heads of any Israeli occupying force. So that's not a very satisfactory solution either. The Israeli problem is that it's certainly true that Israel can't live with a situation in which a significant part of its territory, including large towns, is under constant missile fire. Even if the actual death toll has been very low, normal life can't go on that way, and I don't think that anybody would expect it to. On the other hand, the military means at its disposal have all the limitations that we've been talking about, which brings us back to the question of whether from inside the Middle East or from outside, from Washington, there will be any kind of diplomatic initiative that will provide better answers than a continuation of fighting that is leading nowhere for both sides.
Well, just in closing, Gershom Gorenberg, the role of Egypt, of course, is they clearly have no sympathy for Hamas, who they see as allies of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is Mubarak's opposition. But obviously his stance is making him extremely unpopular at home and in the rest of the Arab world. The means by which Hamas is getting these longer-range rockets is through smuggling through Egypt, presumably originally from Iran. What can be done in terms of what is this incursion likely to do? It does. It seems like it's going to not be particularly good for Mubarak, that border will continue to be porous, won't it?
Well, it's the issue of the border is a serious problem, and that also creates a dilemma for Israel because part of the issue here is that the extent of the Egyptian forces close to the border are limited by the 1979 Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty, At the time, Israel's greatest concern was not having any large concentration of Egyptian forces near its border, which remains a legitimate concern. But the problem is that you would need greater Egyptian strength there to have a more effective role in preventing the smuggling. So on the one hand, Israel doesn't really want to reopen that whole security issue with Egypt. And on the other hand, it wants Egypt to be more efficient in preventing the smuggling. Again, I would say that these are all in the order of attempts to control the problem, to manage the problem, rather than to deal with the political root causes of the problem. You know, can we prevent smuggling here? Can we prevent smuggling there? The long-term issue of redefining a relation between Israel and the Palestinians has to be dealt with on a political, diplomatic level.
I thank you very much for joining us here from Israel today, Gershom Gorenberg.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Gershom Gorenberg, author and journalist based in Israel. His books include The End of Days, Fundamentalism and the Struggle for the Temple Mount, Shalom Friend, The Life and Legacy of Yitzhak Rabin, and his most recent book, The Accidental Empire, Israel and the Birth of the Settlements. I'm now speaking with Scott Horton, who is a writer, analyst, and attorney known for his work on international law, human rights, and the law of armed conflict. He's a professor at Columbia Law School and the author of 100 articles and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. His Harper's web blog, No Comment, is highly regarded and covers issues ranging from American law and politics to international affairs. And Scott Horton, last week on the program, I was speaking with Bruce Fine, who felt that made a passionate case that George Bush and Dick Cheney have broken the law, and the loyal opposition in this country, Pelosi, Reid, et al., are complicit in getting these guys off the hook. So if it's pretty clear that they've broken the law, what's the chance of either of them going to jail or at least some justice being meted out in their direction?
Well, I think we'd have to say the odds are pretty low right now, but I don't think they're completely clear of things. And I guess two considerations. One is the incoming Obama administration. One thing is completely clear, and that is that no final decision has been taken by the Obama administration. You know, what I hear when I talk to their people is this mantra, one president at a time, and, you know, we'll exercise pardon and we'll attend to administration of justice when our administration takes office on January 20th and not before then. So I think there is some possibility of something happen, but the starting point would have to be an investigation. I'm sure, in fact, Bruce discussed that a bit. You know, one of the dilemmas here is that the Justice Department normally would be the entity that would conduct an investigation, but here the Justice Department itself is a massive crime scene. You know, the criminal conduct occurred in the office of the Attorney General, the Deputy Attorney General, the head of the Criminal Division, the Office of Legal Counsel, and several other departments. So it's really unthinkable that this Justice Department could investigate itself. So you'd have to start with the appointment of an outside prosecutor. And to get that far, to appoint the prosecutor, you have to have a sort of preliminary investigation. So that's the dilemma right now. We really haven't even had the preliminary investigation conducted, nor do we have people in the Justice Department who are in a position to conduct the investigation. And in fact, Michael Mukasey, my former partner, is insisting that there will be no investigation.
Well, but what Bruce did point out, though, was that while, you know, it's like fiddling while Rome burns, while the Democrats are trying to muster some courage and equivocating about what to do, Bush and Cheney are aggressively creating facts on the ground. He cited a treaty that they put that they're trying to push through with Georgia. It's not as if we've had enough problems with the impetuous Georgian leader in that ridiculous war, which may not have been encouraged by Randy Scheuneman and John McCain, but we know the results have been incredibly detrimental for the United States and for Europe, and Putin won that one hands down. So what do you know about this treaty that they're trying to stick Obama with?
Well, you know, I think the point's a valid one, because in the view of the America media, we're just all on pause right now, waiting for the inauguration. But in fact, George W. Bush is still president, and while the media portrays him somehow as passive and having retreated off prematurely to Crawford, that's hardly the case. He's not in the headlines, and he's not attempting to make news, but he's feverishly acting behind the scenes. In fact, in addition to this treaty with Georgia, there's a treaty that was concluded with Iraq, which he pushed and pushed to have concluded before he left so he could make his purportedly triumphant trip to Iraq. That's the one where shoes were thrown at him. The Georgian treaty is an effort to bolster the defenses of Georgia. So it's essentially a security cooperation treaty. And the Bush administration and the administration of Mikhail Saakashvili, who in fact used to be my assistant and was one of my students at Columbia, they've had very, very close security cooperation for many years, since Misha came to power following the Rose Revolution. And this is an effort to formalize things. And I think there's no question about what's going on. He's attempting to tie the hands of the Obama administration before it takes office by committing the United States in certain ways to the Georgian government. I think much like the situation in Gaza, there hasn't been much focus on what the Bush administration has done or its role with respect to this conflict in Gaza. But the Jerusalem Post was reporting yesterday evening that new American bunker buster bombs that have been recently designed are being tried out by the Israeli Air Force there.
And I think it's pretty clear that
hand there too.
Right. Well, it's pretty clear that Obama is going to inherit whatever the facts on the ground are after this incursion. And I think you're correct in suggesting that this is another example of tying Obama's hands.
That's right. So I think we see all across the board in the Justice Department busily filing briefs, taking positions. They know the new administration will not endorse concluding a whole series of settlements of enforcement actions against corporations on terms that they know the new administration would never endorse. We look at Guantanamo. New administration is committed on January 20th to closing the military commissions process, and the Bush administration is feverishly trying to push those prosecutions forward. They're planning further indictments before January 20th. They're trying to get early trial dates in all these cases and engaging in tactics which are really unconscionable and certainly unethical. So that just shows that, you know, this administration, they're not looking for headlines because they know they don't have public approval, but they are pushing to do as much damage as they possibly can do. It makes me think of a 3-year-old who's about to have his toy taken away and has decided that rather than share it with his younger brother, he'll destroy the toy. That's what Bush is doing right now.
Well, it's not as if the country hasn't already been a victim of his misrule. This extra tantrum on top of destroying the economy and destroying the national security of the United States, getting the United States into two losing wars, and international disrepute. Again, I'm speaking with Scott Horton, writer, analyst, attorney, professor of at Columbia Law School, and contributing editor Harper's in Legal Affairs National Security. Also has a very popular web blog at Harper's. No comment. The ACLU apparently, Scott, obtained email dated May 22nd, 2004. And we know that millions of emails have gone missing, and nobody seems to be particularly outraged, even though the National Archives are furious. I don't know why the American people aren't seeing a massive smoking gun here. But this May 22nd, 2004 email says that President Bush authorized abuse of Iraqi detainees. Now, the White House is denying this, saying they didn't authorize it, and they're saying that the FBI is mistaken. What do you know about this, and will this get some legs?
Well, that email, we've known of this email for roughly 2 years now, so this isn't a completely new story, although a blogger recently posted about it. But, you know, in fact, we know that the Bush administration issued shortly before the invasion of Iraq an executive order that had something to do with interrogation process, and it's been kept secret. There's probably also a national security determination that went along with it. So we know that there's some documents out there which have been kept very close to the vest by the administration. And when the White House says it didn't authorize torture, I mean, my belief is when we finally see this document, we're going to see that it authorizes other people to authorize torture, so that the White House can honestly say, no, it didn't say go waterboard people in Iraq. They'll have a position, they'll be in a position to make this highly legalistic technical argument. But nevertheless, the purpose of these documents clearly was to overcome prior legal standards which applied the Geneva Conventions and other international instruments, basically to quash those policies and to replace them with a new policy, which really was generated by Vice President Dick Cheney and his Chief of Staff, David Addington, which was designed to enable torture and abuse of prisoners in Iraq, Guantanamo, and other places. This is one area where this administration, which has lived through secrets, has succeeded in maintaining these secrets to this day. We haven't seen the documents, but I think early in the Obama administration, we're going to see a push to force the publication so we can have a public discussion about what Bush authorized and what he did. I think at the end of the day, we're going to see George Bush very, very close to the abuse of prisoners at Abu Ghraib and at Guantanamo. In fact, that's already what Senator Levin's committee concluded, and 12 Republicans on that committee voted for the report that concluded that Bush was responsible for the abuse. That, to me, suggests, and we haven't seen the report because it's classified, that, to me, suggests that there are documents there that make the case and make it in a way that just can't be disputed anymore.
Well, Scott Horton, as you pointed out, there are certainly cases to be filed against President Bush and Vice President Cheney, and whether or not they will be, and whether or not there'll be any accountability is a big question. And the former LA District Attorney Vince Bugliosi wrote a book outlining a case for murder against George W. Bush and challenging every district attorney in the country to file charges after January the 21st of this month. There's rhetorically it's out there. Practically, we have to hold our breaths. But one thing that I also want to talk to you in a moment about this unprecedented activity that's going on in the Senate with four Senate seats up and two of them in dispute. And the Senate, of course, starts business on Tuesday. The clock is ticking on that particular story. But before we go to that, my sense is that I wish that the country would, obviously they just want this guy to go away. And Oliver Stone made a movie about him and nobody wanted to see it because I think they're so fed up with Bush, they've already gotten over him. But that doesn't mean that the story shouldn't be told about who he really is and what he's really done. We have a pretty good idea of what he's done, and it's been a catastrophe. But who is he really? To my mind, I think so much of he's gotten such a free pass as a man of God and a Christian and a man who talks to God and all this these family values and the goodness that he tries to portray. It seems to me that the man could be one of the most cynical enablers of criminality in the history of the United States. I mean, if you look at the bookends of his administration, the first week they took on, they enabled Enron and Kenny Lay, who was the biggest contributor to their campaign, to steal $30 billion from the state of California. And the other bookend is at the end of the misrule of 8 years, is the Enronization of Wall Street, which has allowed a few thousand, perhaps, people to literally steal the global economy and leave it in shambles.
Well, you know, we have a tradition in our country that we don't question somebody's religion. You know, I was taught by my mother that it was very impolite to do that. And that carries to some extent in the political sphere. At least, you know, George W. Bush has been the benefit of that. But, you know, there is a part of his story that really requires a little bit of explanation, and that is his makeover. You know, he ran for a congressional seat out in western Texas and got his rear end handed to him. He was beaten by a Democrat very badly. And afterwards, it's widely reported that, you know, he said, "I'll never be out-hicked again." And it's right after losing that election that suddenly he came to Jesus. And he quit his church. He was an Episcopalian, although not not a church-attending Episcopalian. Suddenly, he left that church, and suddenly he started his flirtation with the religious right. And he used the religious right principally for political purposes. Similarly, the way he speaks, you know, he has this Texas accent. But there are tape recordings of him that go back to the late 70s and early 80s, and when you listen to them, he doesn't have a Texas accent on it. And you know, I think that's another part of a phony persona that was melded, that was crafted for this guy. And this is somebody who, you know, went to prep school at Phillips Andover, went to Yale, went to Harvard. You know, where does the Texas accent come from? I mean, you explain that to me. You know, I think it's an affectation. I think it's something that was put together. So we had a very carefully crafted political persona that Karl Rove put together for this guy, very, very effective. And I think it lasted him into his second term. It got him reelected. Now the wheels have come off that machine, and I think we have millions of Americans looking at this and coming to the realization that we were had, and that's the reason why we've got, you know, 79%, according to a poll published this week, 79% of the American people delighted to see him gone and not really wanting ever to hear from him again.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, Scott Horton, I'd like to touch on the Senate seats. There are four Senate seats that are open. They're supposed to be filled on Tuesday. The one in Colorado looks like it's they found somebody that people agree with, although he's not Hispanic. There's some disquiet about that. But then you've got Carolyn Kennedy. People think that she's not qualified and that Mahoney should do that, and she should take Mahoney's Congress seat. Then you've got Burris, who Blagojevich appointed rather cynically and playing the race card there. And then, of course, you've got Franken, who has increased his lead from 49 now to 225. It seems pretty insurmountable in terms of legal challenges that Coleman will probably level. So what do you think is going to happen in the last two cases?
Well, you know, I think if we look at the voting outcome, the Democrats did not quite hit 60 votes. They're short of this debate-proof supermajority. But, you know, we're looking at four Democratic seats that can be withheld or delayed, and I think Republicans are looking for an opportunity to deprive the Democrats of the advantage of those seats. The Colorado and New York seats will go as the governors there decide. I think Bennett's pretty firm, and I think Caroline Kennedy, that remains to be seen. I think there's still a lot of speculation here in New York that it may go elsewhere. The Illinois seat is an amazing one because there we have a successor appointed, but we have lots of legal problems. The Secretary of State in Illinois is refusing to confirm it. Senator Obama himself, President-elect Obama, opposed the appointment of Burris. You know, I think we'll see a push. We may see special legislation for a new election there. And then we have the Franken seat. It's clear, I think, at this point that Franken won that election. He will be certified, but it may take a little bit more time. You know, under Minnesota law, it's not until this election review and recount process is finalized and certified that the state confirms to Congress in Washington who its senator is. So that hasn't happened. It's coming in after the deadline. And we see Republicans, led by Senator Cornyn from Texas, wanting to obstruct Al Franken taking the seat that is obviously his. And I'm sure they'll play that game for some time to slow it down. So I think this is a lot of it is just pure Washington politics.
But surely, if the Republicans want to filibuster on Coleman's behalf and prevent Franken from being seated, Obama's got some serious leverage here. The American people don't want this kind of nonsense, and they want to give Obama a chance to fix this mess that Bush has handed him. So I can't understand why the Democrats even they don't call their bluff.
Well, as I look at Cornyn's statement, it's not that he was going to finally oppose Franken being seated after the certification comes from Minnesota. What he was opposing was the courtesy seating in advance of the certification.
I see. Uh-huh.
Which is something that's happened from time to time and is a discretionary matter with the Senate. But, you know, remember, at the end of the day, it's the Senate that makes up its own mind as to who is a properly elected senator, and it's state law in each case that determines the outcome of the election. So both of those things need to meet up. I think Al Franken, I think we can say pretty clearly now that, you know, within a month roughly, Al Franken's going to be seated as the new junior senator from Minnesota.
And Illinois is up for grabs. I thank you so much for joining us, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you.
And Happy New Year.
To you too.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Scott Horton, a writer, analyst, attorney, professor of at Columbia Law School, and Harper's Web blog is No Comments. I'd like to thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, G the engineer.